I can hardly believe that this is the sixth time at this pulpit of this reputable church. You invited me back. It makes me wonder, when was the last time we had a congregational mental health check around here? After all, the very definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. Let me emphasize at the outset that my remarks today are intended to calm your fevered state, which seems alarmingly similar to the current unhinged condition of our body politic. Physicians diagnose disease by way of comparing a patient's symptoms to precedents. They recommend treatment options according to what has worked in the past for alleviating symptoms and, wherever possible, healing the underlying causes. My homily seeks to apply this process to understanding what ails our society today, which polls show is more polarized than any time since the tumultuous 1960s. My prescription and prognosis is offered with the acknowledgement that I'm not that kind of a doctor, so you'll need to go elsewhere for your painkillers. Bill Frederick asked me after church 4 months ago if I would put together a guest sermon this coming summer on populism. At that time, the president was only 6 weeks into his term, and pundits were using the term populism to explain how Mr. Trump managed to confound their prognostications, the conventional wisdom, and scads of pollsters to secure his party's nomination and win the presidency. Bill confirmed my own sense that many people were left scratching their heads about what exactly populism was or is, and what role it may have played in that transformational election. So, what is populism? As a historian, I'm inclined to seek definitional clarity. Next, I search for the thing's origins. I try to determine how it has changed or stayed the same from its point of emergence to the present, and explain why. Finally, I look for the thing's significance in its own time and ascertain whether it has any lasting influence. So to the definition. The latest edition of the Oxford English Dictionary succinctly defines populism as, quote, support for the concerns of ordinary people, end quote. The concise Oxford Dictionary of Politics adds that populism connotes, quote, support for the preferences of ordinary people, and that the meaning has always been somewhat derogatory. It continues, insofar as a specific set of populist beliefs can be identified, they involve defense of the supposed traditions of the little man against change as seen as imposed by powerful outsiders. Dutch political scientist Cas Moed has observed that, quote, populism is inherent to representative democracy. After all, do populists not juxtapose the pure people against the corrupt elite? Defined in this way, we could find elements of populism in the American Revolution and its aftermath, especially in Shays' Rebellion, the anti-federalist opponents to ratifying the Constitution, and the Whiskey Rebellion. Please forgive me while I nerd out history professor style here, but you asked, what is populism? So now I address, what was populism? In the mid-19th century, the nativist American Party, better remembered as the Know-Nothings, made populist appeals that were vehemently anti-immigrant and anti-Catholic as more than a million refugees from the Irish potato famine reached our shores. But the term populist itself was first used by discontented farmers in the American Midwest and South in the 1870s and 80s, who were badly hurt by the Panic of 1873, our first Great Depression. The chromolithograph that you saw projected at the start of today's sermon, and that was the cover of the e-blast from a few days ago, titled Gift for the Grangers, was published in that year, 1873, to celebrate an idealized image of the yeoman farmer so extolled by Jefferson, whose place then in society was rapidly being eclipsed by what I call the three shuns of the Gilded Age: industrialization, urbanization, and immigration. The Grange was one of several grassroots or associations of farmers that gravitated toward populism during the Gilded Age, roughly the decades immediately following the Civil War. After two decades of economic dislocation, by the early 1890s, these mostly rural folk, together with the support of other producing classes, such as certain trade unions, formed the People's Party, otherwise known as the Populist Party. In the 1892 election, you just heard the preamble to their platform, they fielded a national presidential candidate, James B. Weaver, in a third-party effort, who received over 1 million popular votes and 22 electoral votes, while electing several members to Congress, including four senators. On the state and local level, they captured three governorships and put hundreds of minor officials and legislators in office. A mere 4 years later, their movement was absorbed into the Democratic Party, and presidential candidate William Jennings Bryan, the leading orator of his day, championed the populist cause, only to go down in a landslide defeat to Republican William McKinley. The Populist Party saw some of their reform agenda adopted into law during the early decades of the 20th century under the stewardship of the Progressive Movement and the New Deal. While they lost the fight for the free coinage of silver, the nationalization of the railroads, and the end of protective tariffs, they did succeed in reforms involving the direct election of U.S. senators. Prior to that, that was something that was voted on by the Senate themselves, and the adoption of a graduated income tax and workmen's compensation laws, and also the right to organize unions and to bargain collectively. More recently, populism as it is, populism has manifested itself across the political spectrum. British political theorist Margaret Canavan has discerned two major types of populism, agrarian and political, with seven subcategories between them, a few including commodity farmer movements that pushed radical economic agendas, such as the Populist Party, participatory democracy advocates who seek reforms through political initiative and referendum, especially seen during the Progressive Era, the first two decades of the 20th century, the populism of politicians who make non-ideological appeals to the people for the purposes of building a unified coalition, and a reactionary populism epitomized by the rise of European fascism in the 1930s and the race baiting of demagogic Southern Democrats during the Civil Rights era. In last year's presidential campaign, the left's populist, Bernie Sanders, shared certain positions with the populist of the right, Donald Trump, when it came to criticizing the NAFTA and Trans-Pacific Partnership free trade agreements. Both focused on the debilitating effects that globalization has had on wage earners and positioned themselves as outsiders with respect to the Washington establishment. So that gives them their bona fides as populists in the historical frame. But there the comparison ends. Senator Sanders, a democratic socialist, pledged to pursue policies that would redistribute wealth from the economic elite to the middle and working classes. Although his campaign promises were sparse on details, Mr. Trump's policy goals as president are unabashedly aligned with the continuing transfer of wealth upward at the expense of the social safety net that the Republican Party has been engineering with some great success since the Reagan administration. The latest versions of the House and Senate Republicans' health care plans to replace Obama's Affordable Care Act would fund large tax cuts for the highest income earners by cutting Medicaid subsidies for the indigent. Using Canavan's classification scheme, President Trump's populism seems to be of the rhetorical kind. His base of support took a leaf from Ronald Reagan's playbook by making appeals to disaffiliated Democrats and winning enough of them over in critical swing states to claim a convincing Electoral College victory despite losing in the popular vote. The question remains whether his most vehement supporters, those who have not historically voted for Republicans, will turn out for his party's candidates in the midterm elections next year if they find that President Trump's ostensible populism fails to bring them the greater share of prosperity that he promised in 2016. So now you know how populism has been defined, a little bit about what it looked like at its inception, and a snapshot of where things stand with populism today. So to my recommended treatment. This is where you might need some painkillers. Unitarian Universalism regards itself as a liberal religion, by which it means a spiritual community that fosters critical thinking free of dogma or fundamentalist doctrine. We are a fellowship of truth seekers who subscribe to a series of principles that must be perpetually engaged through thought, speech, and importantly, action, both as individuals and as a bound congregation. There is nothing in our beliefs that commits us also to a liberal political perspective, and we would do well to remember that UUs are not a religious wing of progressive politics. Just as populism can be of the right, left, or center, so too can the range of our members' views lie across the political spectrum. It is for this reason that my prescription for a populism as it could be is rooted in what we already espouse, our seven principles. Informed by the Judeo-Christian tradition from which the Unitarian and Universalist denominations emerged, and transformed by free-thinking humanists, these tenets of our beloved community could help us avoid those aspects of populism that have proven historically problematic, while embracing those that lead in the direction of greater inclusiveness and empowerment for all Americans. The most relevant of these, it seems to me, are: we believe in the inherent worth and dignity of every person. We believe in justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. We believe in a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. We believe in the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and in society at large. We believe in the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. And we respect the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. With these principles to guide us, a new populism that rejects hatred, racism, sexism, paranoia, homophobia, nativism, and ecocide, which embraces effective education for all, which provides affordable health care, access to nourishing food, decent housing, and public safety, which respects all lives. This recharged populism must first be imagined in order for it to become attainable. A people without vision perishes. My dissertation advisor, Michael Kamen, a winner of the Pulitzer Prize in History, made his students sensible of the paradox at the heart of American civilization: that we are a conservative people in many respects, but but what we conserve is fundamentally radical. Our founding documents, after all, commit us to forge a more perfect union by ensuring that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, though not happiness itself, are guaranteed to all citizens. Equality and justice under the law are recognized therein as our inherent inalienable rights. Consider, no nation in world history had launched its enterprise on such utopian premises. These remain the basis for universal human rights aspired to by other countries that were formed largely out of ethnic or tribal affiliation, instead of, like our own, by dedication to a proposition. Despite our many laudable achievements, we Americans perpetually fall short of fulfilling these lofty commitments. It is part of our national dilemma that we are charged with realizing these ideals, but we must accept that more perfect is as close as we can ever hope to get. Perhaps our greatest political poet of populism, Abraham Lincoln, said it best when he exhorted us to rededicate ourselves to that proposition, that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. Americans are rebellious by patriotic tradition. After all, our revolution was a rising up against the lawful authority of its own time. Great Britain was then the most democratic nation ever known on earth, but it wasn't democratic enough for us. It is now time for us, our generation, to rise up on behalf of the common good, the common wealth, and by so doing, preserve Lincoln's dream that our nation represents the last best hope of Earth.